Welcome to another deep dive. We take incredible source material and unpack it for you. And today we're diving deep into Dr. Robert C. Newman's insights on the miracles of Jesus.
That's right.
And we're really focusing in on his work on miracles over the natural world. So this is going to be an exciting deep dive.
Yes.
Into these really, really key moments in Jesus' ministry.
This is just one section of Dr. Newman's work. He actually looks at the miracles of Jesus in three different categories. Over the natural realm, like we're looking at today, but also over the human realm and over the spirit realm.
Wow.
And so this is just one slice, but we're going to dig deep into this slice today.
And he gives a really good working definition of what a miracle is.
Right.
You know, miracle is not just some cool thing that happened.
Right.
There's a specific definition.
Yeah. It's a striking or wonderful event displaying supernatural power.
Yeah.
And intended to carry a certain significance. And so we want to look at that as we look at these nature miracles.
Exactly.
What is the supernatural power on display? And what is the significance?
And what were the reactions of the people that saw it?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I mean, how can you not be blown away by some of these
things? Oh, right. Exactly.
So what are some of the miracles over the natural world that Dr. Newman covers?
Well, he looks at the changing of water into wine.
Okay.
The miraculous catch of fish, stilling a storm, feeding the 5,000.
Of course.
Feeding the 4,000, walking on water.
Right.
And even finding a coin in a fish's mouth. Now,
okay,
we don't have time to go into detail on all of those today. We're going to focus on just a couple.
Like
the miraculous catch and feeding the 5,000.
Fantastic.
And then maybe just mention the coin in the fish's mouth.
Okay, sounds great. So let's jump into this miraculous catch of fish. This is found in Luke chapter 5.
Right.
Verses 1 through 11. And can you kind of set the scene? What's going on in this passage?
Well, the scene opens on the shore of the Sea of Galilee,
okay,
which is also known as the Lake of Gennesaret.
Okay.
And Jesus is teaching.
Yeah.
And there are crowds of people who are pressing in on him, wanting to hear him.
Right.
And he sees that there are these two boats that have been pulled up on the beach.
Okay.
The fishermen have been fishing all night and they're washing their nets.
Right.
And one of the fishermen is Simon Peter.
Okay.
And Jesus gets into Simon's boat and asks him to push it out a little bit from shore.
Okay.
And he uses the boat as like a floating pulpit.
Right. It's like a natural amphitheater.
Exactly. Exactly.
So he sits down and continues to teach the people.
Right.
So what happens after he's done teaching?
So after he finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out into the deep water and let down your nets for a catch."
Wow.
And Simon answered, "Master, we've worked hard all night and haven't caught anything."
Right.
"But because you say so, I will let down the nets."
That's huge.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a fisherman. He knows fishing.
Yeah.
But he's going to listen to Jesus even though it doesn't make sense.
Right. He's going to trust him.
Right.
Even though he's an expert fisherman.
Right. So what happens?
Well, when they let down their nets, they caught such a huge number of fish that their nets began to break.
What?
And they had to signal to their partners in the other boat to come and help them.
Wow.
And both boats were so full that they began to sink.
That's incredible. So it's more than just like a good catch of fish.
Yeah.
It's like supernatural abundance.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's overwhelming.
So what's Peter's reaction to this?
Well, when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord. I am a sinful man."
Wow.
And all the people were astonished at the catch of fish that they had taken.
Yeah.
And so were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon.
Wow. So there's that sense of awe, terror almost.
Yes.
In the presence of the holy.
Right. Exactly.
And so how does Jesus respond to Peter's exclamation?
Well, he said to Simon, "Don't be afraid. From now on, you will be catching men."
Wow.
And when they had brought their boats to shore, they left everything and followed him.
So this was a life-changing event.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, Dr. Newman talks about the historicity of this event.
Yes, he does.
So what points does he raise about that?
Well, he points out that this event occurs very early in Jesus's public ministry in Galilee.
Okay.
Right after a period of teaching and casting out demons.
Okay.
And already people are pressing in on him to hear him.
Right.
So it makes sense that he would use a boat as a platform to address this large crowd.
Right.
It's very practical.
Yeah.
And the disciples had already worked hard all night without success.
Right. So this isn't just a matter of him knowing where the fish are or the time of day or something.
Yeah. No, it's not that.
So Dr. Newman also addresses what he calls liberal explanations for this miracle.
Yes, he does.
So what are some of those?
Well, one very common explanation is that this is just an allegory.
Okay.
It's not meant to be a historical event.
Okay.
But rather it's symbolic.
Yeah.
So, for example, the fruitless night of fishing might symbolize the apostles' initial lack of success in reaching the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
But then the huge catch might symbolize their future success in reaching the Gentiles.
I see.
And Jesus's words about catching men
were
seen as the key to the symbolic interpretation.
So it's like a teaching moment.
Right.
It's not so much a miraculous event.
Right.
And what does Dr. Newman say about that?
Well, he acknowledges that there is a symbolic dimension to this miracle, especially given Jesus' own interpretation of it about becoming fishers of men.
Right.
But he challenges the idea that we should dismiss the historicity of the event altogether.
Right.
So he also addresses a related suggestion.
Okay.
That maybe Jesus simply saw a school of fish.
Okay.
And directed the disciples to that spot.
Right.
But here he brings in a fascinating point about the limits of human vision in water.
Okay. This is where it gets interesting.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So imagine a person standing in a boat. Their eyes are about 6 feet above the surface of the water.
Okay.
Well, due to the way light refracts at the surface,
okay,
they can only see down about 7 feet at a critical angle.
Oh, wow.
So that means they can't see out very far horizontally.
Right.
So spotting a large school of fish at a distance and being able to direct the fishermen to that precise spot would be virtually impossible.
That's amazing. I never even thought about that.
Yeah.
So he's grounding it in the reality of the physics of the situation.
Exactly.
So what other evidence does he offer for the historicity of this?
Well, he points to the fact that Luke's account includes all sorts of specific details, like the names of the individuals involved, the fact that there were two boats, the fact that the nets began to break.
Right.
All of these specifics strongly suggest an eyewitness account.
Right.
And he contrasts the feel of this miracle with the often fanciful and exaggerated miracles found in apocryphal writings from the same era. So, you know, those writings, they often have these sort of outlandish miracles that don't really have this kind of gritty realism to them.
Right.
And finally, the fact that Peter reacts the way he does with this deep sense of his own sinfulness and the presence of such power lends further weight to the reality of the event.
It's not just like, oh, cool, lots of fish.
Right.
It's this overwhelming sense of God's presence.
Exactly.
Which, again, we see in the Old Testament a lot when people encounter God.
Yes.
They're just aware of their sinfulness.
Right. And of course, the disciples leave everything to follow him immediately after this.
Right. I mean, that speaks volumes about how seriously they took this event.
Exactly.
So moving on to some Old Testament background.
Right.
Are there any events or themes in the Hebrew scriptures that this miracle connects to?
Well, he mentions a couple of things.
Okay.
First, there's the story of Jonah and the great fish.
Right.
Which shows that God has sovereign control over even the creatures of the sea. And then there are all the times when God moves vast numbers of animals, like the plagues of Egypt,
right,
the provision of quail in the wilderness.
Okay, yeah.
So these are both examples of God's power over nature.
Yeah.
And they help us to understand how he might have performed this miracle.
Are there any Old Testament passages that aren't necessarily miracles but still relate to this?
Well, there are passages like Genesis chapter 1, verse 28.
Okay.
And Psalm 8, 6 through 8.
Right.
That speak of humanity's original dominion over the fish.
Oh, interesting.
And then you have Genesis chapter 9, verse 2.
Okay.
Where after the fall, the animals, including the fish, are said to fear and be subject to humans in a new way.
I see.
So this miracle might be seen as a hint at the restoration of that original dominion through Jesus.
Okay, that's interesting.
And there's also a passage in Job, chapter 12, verses 7 through 10, that reminds us that all of creation is in the hand of God, including the fish.
Right, he's the one who made them. So what's the overall significance of this miraculous catch?
Well, on the one hand, there's the immediate impact.
Good.
The disciples catch a huge number of fish.
Right.
And this reveals something about the power of Jesus.
Right.
But it also has significance for the larger story of salvation history.
Okay.
As we saw earlier, it might point to Jesus as the second Adam.
Right.
Who's beginning to restore what was lost in the fall.
Right.
And then, of course, there's Jesus's own interpretation of the miracle.
Okay.
He says that the disciples will become fishers of men.
Right.
Gathering people into the kingdom of God.
Okay.
So this miracle is a sign of God's power to bring success in both the natural realm of fishing.
Right.
And in the spiritual realm of saving people.
That's a great point. So moving on, let's talk about another very well-known miracle, the feeding of the 5,000.
Okay.
This one is recorded in all four Gospels.
Right.
Which is really interesting.
Yeah.
And it tells us something about its importance.
It does, yeah.
And Dr. Newman focuses on John's account of this event.
Okay.
So can you give us a little background on this miracle?
Sure. So John chapter 6 tells us that Jesus crossed the Sea of Galilee.
Okay.
And a large crowd followed him because they had seen the miraculous signs that he was doing on the sick.
Okay.
So Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples.
Okay.
And it was near the time of the Jewish Passover festival.
Okay.
So that's important for understanding the crowd, maybe why they were there.
Right. So there's a lot of people.
Right.
And they're going to need to eat something.
Yeah, they're hungry.
So what prompts this miraculous feeding?
Well, when Jesus looked up and saw a large crowd coming towards him, he said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?"
Okay.
And John tells us that he said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do.
Okay.
Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There's a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish." Okay. But what are they for so many?
Right, they're totally insufficient.
Right.
So what does Jesus do?
Well, Jesus said, "Have the people sit down."
Okay.
Now, there was much grass in the place.
Okay.
So the men sat down, about 5,000 of them.
Just men?
Yeah, just men.
So women and children not included?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
And Jesus took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish.
Yeah.
And looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke them and gave them to the disciples. And the disciples gave them to the people.
Okay.
And they all ate and were satisfied.
Wow.
And when they had gathered up the leftover fragments, 12 baskets were full.
That is just incredible.
Mm.
12 baskets of leftovers.
Yeah.
After 5 loaves and 2 fish.
Exactly.
So what was the crowd's reaction?
Well, when the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world." Oh. Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself.
Wow. So he's displaying this incredible power that's causing people to say he's the Messiah.
Yes. Yes.
So Dr. Newman talks about the historicity of this miracle.
Yes, he does.
So what does he say about that?
Well, first of all, it's significant that this miracle is recorded in all 4 Gospels.
Yeah.
And each account provides a slightly different set of details.
Okay.
Which suggests that they're independent.
Okay.
And not simply copying from one another.
Okay.
He also points to specific details.
Okay.
Like the mention of the location near Bethsaida.
Okay.
The green grass, which suggests it happened in the springtime.
Right.
The term kofanoi, which was the word for Jewish wicker food baskets.
Okay.
And the unusual detail of the disciples gathering the leftover fragments. Now, this is something you don't find in a lot of legendary miracle stories.
Right.
The food just appears and disappears. But here, there's an awareness of waste and a concern for practicality.
Yeah, that's an interesting detail. So what are some of the liberal explanations for this miracle?
Well, one explanation is that it was really a lesson in sharing.
Okay.
The idea is that many people in the crowd actually had brought their own food.
Okay.
But they were reluctant to share it,
perhaps
because they felt they didn't have enough.
Yeah, okay.
But when the boy offered his small lunch,
right,
it shamed them into bringing out their own food.
Oh, okay.
And in this way, everyone had enough.
I see.
So it wasn't a miracle. It was just a lesson in sharing.
Oh.
Another explanation is that the story was simply invented or embellished to draw a parallel with the feeding miracles of Elijah and Elisha,
right,
which are found in 1 Kings 17 and 2 Kings 4.
Okay.
So the idea is that the early Christians wanted to show that Jesus was a greater prophet than these Old Testament figures.
I see.
So they made up a story about him feeding a larger crowd. And again, in this view, the event wasn't historical.
So what's Dr. Newman's response to these liberal explanations?
Well, he points to the strong and diverse attestation in all 4 Gospels.
Okay.
The specific details like the kofanoi baskets.
Okay.
And the green grass.
Okay.
And the collection of leftovers all lend weight to the historical reality of the event.
It's not just a made-up story.
Right, exactly.
So are there any Old Testament connections that help us to understand this miracle?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
The most obvious parallel is the provision of manna in the wilderness during the Exodus.
Right.
And this event is recorded in a number of Old Testament books. Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Nehemiah, Psalms.
Wow, so it's a key event in Israel's history.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's a central event.
Okay.
And there's also the miraculous provision of quail in the wilderness.
Okay.
Which is another example of God directly feeding his people.
Right.
And then there are the stories of Elijah and the widow of Zarephath, where the jar of flour and the jug of oil were miraculously sustained.
Okay.
And the story of Elisha multiplying the loaves of bread.
Right.
These are all relevant examples of God's provision through his messengers.
So there's this precedent for God providing food for people in need.
Right. Exactly.
Are there any other connections to the Old Testament that Dr. Newman highlights?
Well, he mentions Psalm 104, verse 27 following.
Okay.
And Psalm 132:15.
Okay.
Which speak of God providing food for all of creation.
Right.
And blessing his people with abundance.
Okay.
He also touches on some rabbinic traditions concerning the eschatological banquet.
Okay.
In which the great sea monster, Leviathan, and the great land monster, Behemoth, are prepared as food for the righteous in the messianic age.
Okay.
So there's this expectation of a great feast.
Wow.
That God will provide.
So what's the significance of the feeding of the 5,000 in light of all of this?
Well, on a practical level, it resulted in more than 5,000 people being fed, and there were even leftovers.
Right, which is incredible.
It is.
And this led some to try to make Jesus king.
Right, exactly.
So in terms of salvation history, Dr. Newman draws a parallel with Moses feeding Israel in the wilderness.
Yes.
Which further supports the idea that Jesus is the prophet like Moses, who was promised in Deuteronomy 18:15.
Right. However, he also points out a key difference.
Okay.
In the case of the manna, Moses announced God's provision.
Okay.
But in this case, Jesus himself takes the bread and fish, gives thanks, and breaks them.
Okay.
And then the multiplication occurs.
So it's much more direct.
It is much more direct.
Oh.
And then, in terms of symbolic meaning,
okay,
Dr. Newman draws our attention to Jesus' teaching the very next day,
right,
when he declares himself to be the bread of life.
Right.
And he contrasts himself with the manna that Moses provided,
okay,
which only sustained physical life.
Right.
But Jesus offers spiritual life.
Right. He's the true bread from heaven.
Exactly. And he also connects this event to his giving of his own life.
Okay.
Seeing in the breaking of the bread a foreshadowing of his sacrifice on the cross.
Okay.
And a link to the future institution of the Lord's Supper.
That's an interesting connection.
It is, isn't it?
So this miracle is about much more than just physical hunger.
Right.
It's ultimately pointing to the spiritual nourishment that Jesus provides.
Right. Exactly.
So let's move on to one last miracle. The finding of a coin in a fish's mouth.
Okay.
This one's a little different.
It is a bit different.
Than the ones we've looked at so far.
Right.
It's found in Matthew chapter 17.
Okay.
So can you tell us about this miracle?
Sure. So the scene opens with Jesus and his disciples arriving in Capernaum.
Okay.
After a teaching tour.
Okay.
And the tax collectors who collected the 2 drachma temple tax came to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?"
Okay.
He said, "Yes."
So Peter assumes that Jesus pays the tax.
Yeah. And when he went into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?"
Okay.
And when he said from others, Jesus said to him, "Then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a stater. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself."
Wow. So that's pretty amazing.
It is. Yes.
Jesus knows that there's going to be a fish.
Yeah.
With a coin in its mouth.
Exactly.
And it's going to be the first fish that Peter catches.
Exactly.
And it's going to have the exact amount of money to pay the tax for both of them.
Yeah. It's pretty detailed.
That's incredible. So Dr. Newman talks about the historicity of this miracle.
Yes, he does.
So what points does he raise about that?
Well, he points out that this event occurs relatively late in Jesus' Galilean ministry.
Okay.
And that during this period, Jesus was often keeping a low profile in places like Capernaum.
Right. He was trying to avoid conflict with the authorities.
Exactly.
Okay.
He also explains that the tax in question was the half shekel temple tax.
Okay.
Which was equivalent to 2 drachmas.
Okay.
And that the term stater was a common word for a tetradrach.
Okay.
Which is a 4 drachma coin.
Right.
Which is exactly the amount needed for 2 people.
Right. That's amazing.
Yeah. He also points out that Matthew's gospel uses the technical term didrachmas,
okay,
which is the contemporary term for this tax,
okay,
rather than simply using the Septuagint term.
I see.
Which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament.
Okay.
So this suggests that Matthew's account is based on an actual event.
Okay, so it's not just making up a story.
Right.
It's grounded in the historical reality of the time.
Exactly.
And he also emphasizes the significance of Jesus' statement about being exempt from the tax.
Right.
Which suggests that he sees himself as having a unique relationship with God.
Right.
As the Son of God.
Right.
He's not obligated to pay the temple tax. And he's also suggesting something about Peter's relationship with God.
Right.
That he's also, in some sense, a son.
Right.
And therefore exempt.
That's interesting. Now, it's interesting to me that we don't actually see Peter's reaction
right
to this miracle.
Yeah, it's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we see the other disciples reacting
yeah.
to the miraculous catch of fish. But here it's like, it just happened.
Right. We're just told that Jesus said this would happen.
Right.
And then we assume that it did happen.
Right.
We don't get any confirmation from Peter
right.
or any of the other disciples.
It's almost like it's so mundane.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, of course there's going to be a fish with a coin in its mouth.
Right. Why wouldn't there be?
Yeah, that's kind of strange.
It is a bit strange.
So are there any Old Testament parallels
yeah.
that can help us understand this?
Well, there are the miracles involving the movement or control of animals.
Okay.
Like the story of Jonah and the great fish.
Right.
Or the provision of quail in the wilderness. These miracles show that God can direct animals to do his will.
Right. Like he has this power over creation.
Exactly.
To move animals wherever he wants.
Right. And there are also miracles of financial provision.
Okay.
Like when the prophet Elisha multiplied the oil for the widow.
Right.
In 2 Kings 4.
So God can provide financially for his people.
He can. Yes.
And finally, there's the element of divine foreknowledge.
Okay.
That's at play here.
Right.
Like in the Old Testament, when Samuel knew future events concerning Saul.
Okay.
In 1 Samuel chapter 10.
I see. So God knows the future.
Yeah.
And he can orchestrate events to fulfill his purposes.
Right.
And we see that in this miracle.
We do. Yeah.
So what's the significance of this miracle?
Well, on one level, it's very simple.
Okay.
The temple tax is paid.
Right.
And Jesus and Peter don't cause any offense.
Right.
But Jesus also uses this opportunity to teach Peter about his identity.
Right.
And perhaps about the identity of his followers.
Right.
So in terms of salvation history.
Okay.
This miracle subtly underscores the fact that the one who controls even the creatures of the sea.
Yeah.
Has come to earth.
Right.
And this highlights Jesus's unique relationship with the Father.
Right.
A relationship that sets him apart even in matters of religious obligation.
Right.
Like the temple tax, which was connected to atonement.
Right.
And he also hints at the idea that his followers are being brought into a similar relationship with God.
Oh, wow.
Where they too are considered sons.
Right.
And therefore exempt from the temple tax.
That's really interesting. Now, does Dr. Newman say anything about the symbolic significance of this miracle?
He does mention the connection between the half-shekel temple tax
oh, okay.
and the concept of atonement.
Okay.
Which we see in Exodus chapter 30, verses 13 through 16.
Okay.
Where it's described as an offering to make atonement for one's life or soul.
So it's a reminder that we need to be reconciled to God.
Exactly.
Okay.
And Jesus's actions in this miracle,
okay.
both acknowledging the obligation to pay the tax.
Right. And yet implying his own exemption from it.
Right.
Might prompt us to think about the Christian's relationship to the law.
Okay, yeah.
And its requirements.
So this could be an area for further study and reflection.
It could be, yeah.
So that was an amazing look at these nature miracles. And I think it's so clear from Dr. Newman's analysis
yeah.
that these aren't just displays of power.
No.
But they're pregnant with meaning. Expert speaker.